Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Midnight has passed, and in the stillness of these hours, the hauntings are never silent. This is Real Ghost Stories Online. After midnight.
There are stories that start with a whisper in the dark and stories that begin with a name spoken out loud. A name you know belongs to you, spoken by a stranger's voice. Jennifer's story begins with both. She was 7 years old the first time she met the man who would never let her go. It was an ordinary summer afternoon, the kind of day when the air hums with cicadas and screen doors sigh shut. Jennifer had gone with her papa to visit her godfather's house. So the grown-ups were deep in their quiet conversations, so Jennifer asked if she could play outside on the porch swing. Her papa agreed, and she remembers stepping out into the sunlight, feeling that small thrill of freedom children feel when adults aren't watching too closely. She noticed him before she sat down, a man standing on the sidewalk in front of the house wearing a plain white shirt and blue jeans. At first, nothing about him seemed extraordinary until he turned his head toward her. His skin carried a faint greenish cast, as if he were standing under the wrong kind of light, and his eyes were the most piercing green she had ever seen. Black hair, slicked back in a style she would later compare to Elvis Presley's. He smiled as if he already knew her. "Hello, Jennifer," he said. The porch swing creaked as she sat down, watching him with a child's guarded curiosity. She didn't know this man. She had never seen him before. But he walked up the steps and settled beside her as though he belonged there. His presence carried no scent of sweat or grass or tobacco. Nothing to ground him in the ordinary. "I've been watching you," he told her. The words were strange enough to freeze her thoughts for a second. "You have?" she asked, tilting her head, trying to decide if she was supposed to be flattered or afraid. He rested a hand on her left leg, not roughly, but with the strange authority of someone who thought he had the right. "You've been a good girl," he said. Jennifer, desperate to be polite, smiled back and said she tried to make her mom happy. Even now, she remembers that flash of childish pride and how quickly it turned to dread when the porch door opened and her papa stepped outside. She will never forget the look on his face. His eyes went wide, his mouth tightened, and all the color drained from his skin. It was the look of a man who had just seen a ghost, not a gentle one. "Get inside." "Now," he barked. Jennifer hesitated, confused, and stood up slowly, glancing back at the man in the white shirt. By the time she reached the top step, her papa had a Bible in his hand. He grabbed her wrist, ready to drag her through the doorway, his voice rising in a prayer she couldn't fully hear. The stranger stood as well. He looked at Jennifer one last time, his green eyes fixed on her. "I'll be back for you," he said. And then, before her eyes, he turned to smoke, a curl of darkness rising and vanishing in the warm air. Inside, her papa and his friend Schubert fell to their knees, praying fast, words tumbling over each other. Her papa was crying so hard he could barely speak. Jennifer stood in the corner clutching her towel, asking who the man had been. Papa only told her in a hard, clipped voice never to ask about it again. That night marked the beginning of a lifetime of questions that would go unanswered. Jennifer remembers, even before that encounter, the strange things that had already been happening in her room at home. Objects shifting without explanation. Whispers in the dark that stopped when the lights came on. One night, her mother awoke to see the figure of a man standing at Jennifer's bedroom door. Her mother grabbed a gun from the nightstand, ready to fire, but when she charged the hallway, the figure was gone. No sign of forced entry. No one in the house. Her mother's fear turned into long, silent prayers at breakfast the next morning. Jennifer asked her papa again about the man on the porch. He denied everything. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said, but his eyes betrayed something he wasn't willing to share. Years later, after her mother remarried, Jennifer moved to Knoxville to live in her stepfather's house, and her new bedroom was on the ground floor. She remembers walking in for the first time and feeling an immediate heaviness, as if the room itself were holding its breath. Within days, the old pattern returned, voices at night, the sound of knuckles rapping gently on the door, though everyone else in the house was asleep. She told herself it had to be nerves, that she was imagining things until the activity followed her from house to house long after she was grown. She describes how pictures she took would often show shapes and shadows no one could explain, how objects shifted in the night, how wherever she lived, the sense of being watched never fully left. The years rolled forward, carrying her into adulthood, into marriage. By July of 2002, she thought she had learned to live with the strange disturbances, the knocks, the whispers, until that summer night when the haunting returned in full force. She remembers the date clearly, July 25th. She'd had an unremarkable evening, nothing to hint at what was coming. She got ready for bed, expecting an ordinary night's sleep, but as soon as she closed her eyes, he was there. The man from the porch. Only now he wore a navy blue jacket and moved with an inhuman speed, his shape a black swirl darting inches from her face. His eyes glowed a burning green, bright enough to light the dark. She says he stopped abruptly, leaned close, and laughed, a sound she felt in her bones more than she heard. Then, as if to prove he could, he yanked her hair and slapped her hard across the face. Jennifer tried to scream, but no sound came. Her body locked rigid, her voice trapped in her throat. She felt herself frozen in place, helpless, as though her own body were betraying her. Jennifer says that moment felt endless, her mind screaming while her body refused to obey. She could see the green glow of his eyes in the dark, feel the sting of his palm still burning on her cheek. The black swirl of his body hovered just above her face, then darted side to side as if amused by her paralysis. Her next memory is of her husband's voice breaking through the terror. "Jennifer! Oh my God! Are you okay?" The sound snapped her back like a rope tugging her out of deep water. She jolted upright, sobbing so hard she couldn't catch her breath. Tears streamed down her face as she shouted, "Did you see him?" Her husband stared at her, alarmed and confused. "See who?" he asked. "The man," she cried, clutching her own hair as if to prove it had been pulled. But her husband shook his head. All he'd seen, he told her, was her body jerking under the covers, shaking as if she were having a seizure. He swore he'd seen her hair move as though an invisible hand had yanked it, but there had been no one in the room but her. Jennifer could hardly speak, still gasping between sobs. The adrenaline left her shaking until dawn. The next morning, she drove straight to her papa's house, desperate for answers. She walked in, already bracing for the dismissal she expected to hear. The same words she'd heard so many times before, that she was imagining things, that it was just a dream. But this time felt different. This time she wasn't a frightened 7-year-old. This time she had seen him again. She sat at the kitchen table across from her grandparents and said, "We need to talk." Her voice was steady, but her hands trembled. She described every detail, the man's black, Elvis-like hair, his glowing green eyes, the navy blue jacket he'd worn, the way he moved like smoke in the dark. She told them it was the same man she had seen as a child on the porch swing, the same man who'd promised he'd be back for her. Her grandmother listened quietly at first, then began to cry. Her papa's head lowered, his shoulders stiffening. When Jennifer finished, her grandmother stood up and walked to a small cabinet in the corner. She returned carrying a worn photograph and handed it to Jennifer. "Is this him?" her grandmother asked. Jennifer says the moment she saw the picture, her stomach dropped. Her breath caught in her chest. The face staring back at her was the same face that had haunted her dreams. The same green eyes, the same dark hair. She felt tears prick at the corners of her eyes. She looked up, stunned, and whispered, "Who is this man? Why has he been following me all these years? Why is he hurting me?" Her grandmother's voice broke as she answered, "Jennifer, that's your grandfather." Jennifer was stunned. "Papa is my grandfather," she said, her voice small. Her grandmother shook her head. "No, sweetheart. Papa is your step-grandfather. This is your mother's father. Your real grandfather. His name was Frank." Jennifer felt the room tilt around her. She couldn't reconcile the image of the kind man she knew as her papa with the green-eyed stranger who'd been terrorizing her. She listened as her grandmother went on. Frank, she explained, had been a violent man in life, abusive to Jennifer's mother and uncles, cruel to Jennifer's grandmother. He had followed the family across state lines, determined to reclaim them. Years before Jennifer was born, her grandmother had sent her daughter, Jennifer's mother, away to safety. Frank came looking for them anyway.
One night, a confrontation turned deadly. He was shot by Jennifer's great aunt in an act of protection.
He died on July 25th, 1979, the same date that would later mark the night of Jennifer's attack in 2002. Jennifer sat frozen as her grandmother finished the story. Her grandfather's last words, she said, were as chilling as anything Jennifer had experienced. Lying wounded and bleeding out, Frank had laughed when Jennifer's mother tried to pray with him. "It's too late," he told her. "I sold my soul a long time ago." Moments later, he died. Jennifer's heart pounded in her ears as she tried to process it all. The man who had haunted her since she was 7 had been dead before she was born. She turned to her papa, the man who had been her protector all her life, and asked why he had kept this from her, why he had let her believe she was losing her mind all these years. Papa's answer was heavy with regret. "People wouldn't believe you," he said. "They'd call you crazy. I didn't want that for you, and I didn't want you to know what kind of man he was. But it was too late for protection." Jennifer realized that Frank, her real grandfather, deep, had been following her for as long as she could remember, perhaps drawn to her because she so closely resembled her mother. Her papa confessed he believed Frank's spirit had attached itself to her at birth. Jennifer says in that moment, all the strange events in her life suddenly felt connected. The moving objects, the voices in her childhood bedroom, her mother waking up to a man at the door who wasn't there, the relentless sense of being watched. The revelation didn't bring peace. It brought new fear, the kind that comes with knowing the threat is not a stranger, but blood. Not random, but tied to you by family and something darker. Jennifer says the truth about Frank settled over her like a weight she couldn't shrug off. It explained everything, yet it solved nothing. She wasn't haunted by a stranger. She was haunted by family. In the weeks after her grandparents' confession, the old disturbances began to feel more personal, as if every knock, every whisper, was a reminder that he was still near. Jennifer says she stopped thinking of the haunting as random shadows and started thinking of it as Frank himself, watching from just out of sight. The years moved on. She built a life of her own, but the activity never fully faded. Objects shifted across shelves. Photographs captured shapes that weren't there in the room. There were nights when she heard water drip onto her skin, only to find no source, no leaky faucet, no damp ceiling. Her children, still small, sometimes pointed at empty doorways as though someone had just passed by. One of her children, barely able to talk, began calling out "Mama" in the middle of the night, even while she was standing right beside him. It was as if they were speaking to someone else in the room. Jennifer says that's when she felt the deepest chill, the possibility that Frank's attention had shifted to the next generation. She's had her houses blessed more than once. She's prayed over every doorway, lit candles, invited pastors to walk the halls with Bibles open. Still, the disturbances return. Her papa insists she has a gift, an openness that draws the unseen. But Jennifer calls it something else entirely, a lifelong curse. She lives with a constant low-grade fear that never truly leaves, a fear not of death, but of the living shadow of a man who should have stayed buried. There are moments she remembers with almost physical clarity, nights when she's alone in a quiet room and suddenly feels the weight of eyes on her back, the echo of a voice saying her name. She describes the feeling as the atmosphere itself tightening, the air growing heavy enough to press against her lungs. She has even sought medical answers. Three separate doctors, she says, have evaluated her over the years and found nothing wrong. No hallucinations, no delusions, she tells me. They say I'm fine, but I know what I've seen. What unsettles her most is the date that keeps circling back, July 25th, the day Frank died in 1979. The same night he appeared to her decades later, laughing in her face, yanking her hair, slapping her into silence. Every year when July approaches, she finds herself bracing for something unseen, as though the day itself carries an invitation. Jennifer believes Frank was a violent man in life and that death didn't tame him. Her mother once told her that as Frank lay bleeding out from the gunshot wound that killed him, she had tried to offer him forgiveness, urging him to pray with her before it was too late. He'd looked at her and laughed. "It's too late," he told her. "I sold my soul a long time ago." Those were his last words. Jennifer says that sentence haunts her as much as the man himself. The idea that he'd chosen whatever dark path kept him tethered to the living. She wonders if the violence and cruelty that marked his life became the very thing that chained his spirit to her. Even now, she says, she sometimes catches sight of figures moving just out of her peripheral vision. A flicker of someone slipping past a doorway or standing near the foot of her bed. Her children growing older sometimes describe the same sightings without knowing her history. She tries to keep her voice calm when she reassures them, though inside she feels the same dread she's carried since childhood. The haunting has left her feeling as though her life is divided into two worlds, the ordinary world of sunlight and errands, and the other one shadowed, watchful, threaded through every room she's ever lived in. On her worst nights, she lies awake imagining what Frank might try next, fearing that the harm he once inflicted in life could spill over into her present. She's learned that prayer brings her a sense of protection, even if it doesn't banish the presence entirely. Sometimes that's enough, a small shield that lets her sleep a few hours without jolting awake to a sound she can't trace. Other nights she wakes anyway, heart pounding, convinced she's not alone. Jennifer's story doesn't end with an exorcism or a clean escape. It ends where real hauntings often do, in endurance. A woman raising her children while carrying the weight of a family history she never asked for. A promise made on a porch swing by a man long dead, echoing across decades. "I'll be back for you." She tells me that no matter how many blessings she's had performed on her homes, no matter how often she's tried to build a wall of faith between herself and the thing that lingers, the sense of being followed has never left her. "I'll probably live in fear for the rest of my life," she says. "I'm not crazy. I just know what I've seen. And I know he hasn't stopped." Her voice carries a steadiness that's more unsettling than tears. It's the tone of someone who's stopped asking whether the nightmare will end and has started focusing only on surviving it. That's where we leave Jennifer tonight, a woman who has spent her life pursued by the shadow of her own bloodline, a woman still haunted by green eyes that should have closed forever. In 1979, somewhere between memory and presence, Frank still lingers. The man who laughed at forgiveness, the man who turned to smoke on a summer porch and promised he'd return. And if you're listening to this in a quiet room of your own, you may find yourself thinking of the last words Jennifer's grandfather ever spoke, words that echo like a warning from somewhere past the grave. It's too late. I sold my soul a long time ago.
Want more real ghost stories? Then press subscribe now so you don't miss any of the multiple new ghost stories we drop for you every day. Only here at Real Ghost Stories Online.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.